Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the November investment call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Wes McCann. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Celine. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Wes McCann, president of the Naples Trust Company, a division of the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company. Thank you for joining us for today's quarterly investment call. As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Consult your financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing strategies or recommendations discussed during this call. And now I'd like to welcome Ian Bruce, Chief Investment Officer, and Tim Vick, Director of Research, who will be answering today's questions. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello, West.
Hi, West.
All right. So we're going to jump in. 3 months ago, guys, the volatility that we were seeing in the market was elevated. Today, that seems to have disappeared. Where markets are at all-time high. Investors seem to be a little more optimistic again. Tim, these feel like fair statements to you?
Yes, on all three fronts, West. The volatility is much reduced in what we saw over the summer. Of course, the market has surged, and I sense that investors are a little bit more optimistic than they were over the summer. I mean, when we had our last conference call back in August, I think the S&P was bobbing up and down. It was threatening to break down and perhaps go into another correction based on the economic fears that were prevalent at the time. And this continued really until early October when we saw the first round of companies begin to report earnings. And then just like that, a switch seemed to flip in the market, and, you know, the market power to a new high. And I always tell people that you have to be patient with the market, and it always seems to rally when people least expect it, but you just have to be in a position to participate when the market does give you these surges. And I have to pat my colleagues on the back that they put clients in a position to participate.
So, you know, again, when we last spoke, bond yields were falling, the yield curve was inverting and certainly flat. Everyone's worried about the looming recession, you know, being forecast by that inverted yield curve. Ian, is the recession scenario and those factors, are they out of the, are they off the table now?
Well, I think in terms of what we can learn from the yield curve, the answer is yes. You know, the Fed took action throughout this year, lowering the federal funds rate three different times. And subsequently, the yield curve has reinflated, which is a good sign. So the Fed did, you know, they brought rates lower. The market liked that. Longer-term bonds sold off once again, and then rates went modestly higher over just the past several weeks. So the yield curve does remain flat, but at least the inversion is no longer. Now, regarding just broader recessionary concerns, there is still a viewpoint that we're going to slow at some point next year. You know, we happen to be pretty optimistic about next year, but at some point the bears will be right and we'll get a slowdown and eventually a recession. But as we've said many times in the past, slowdowns, recessions, bull markets, they come and go, and we don't change what we're doing in response to those short-term market moves.
Okay. And, you know, there's talk in the financial press right now that this rally that we're enjoying is really a lot of managers putting money to work or putting money back to work, money that's been, you know, previously sitting on the sidelines. Do you think this bears out, Tim?
Well, I definitely think that's a factor in why the market's been rallying the last several weeks. You go back earlier in the year, there was a lot of negative sentiment building during the year, and more cash was building up on the sidelines. And this was because of the fears Ian was just talking about. The yield curve was inverting, which, of course, triggered some recession concerns. We had the trade war still looming. Some of that's off the table now. And lo and behold, we get into the third quarter. Earnings weren't as bad as people thought. The market starts moving up, and I think a lot of money managers were caught flat-footed. I saw earlier in the year that about half of money managers, professionals, the hedge funds, the macro timers, the pension funds were keeping up with the market, but that number had really dropped by the end of the third quarter, and I think a lot of managers are in catch-up mode right now. You know, they've woken up. This market's suddenly up more than 20%, and their portfolios are not up nearly as much, and a lot of money is going back into this market just to catch up.
So, you know, market rally, yield curve is shaped correctly. What evidence is there for any recession fears out there? What are corporate earnings telling you right now?
Well, if I were to try to parse a common theme out of all the earnings reports, it's that there still is weakness economically around the world, but it's mostly concentrated in China and Europe. And, of course, that stands to reason because they're major trading partners with each other. And their problems are peripherally spreading to the United States. We're seeing it impact a few pockets of industry in the United States, particularly farming, oil and gas, manufacturing, shippers, railroads, companies like that. And also, we've seen some hand-picked economic data that shows that pockets of the rest of the economy have slowed a little bit, particularly in housing. You know, housing starts, housing turnover, housing prices have kind of stalled. Manufacturing has been in a recession really since early 2018. As I said, the railroads are seeing that their traffic in terms of the carloads of goods shipped around the country has stalled for the last year. These were the types of evidence of recession that we've been seeing out there.
So while rates have moderated, still very, very low from a historical perspective, you've got, and in fact, in some places in Europe and Japan, we have negative bond yields, Ian. So what's driving where we have yields that are so low or even negative, and does that have a chance of spreading, you know, into the U.S.?
Well, sure. Yeah, you know, both Europe and Japan are experimenting. I use that term intentionally with negative interest rates because I think we're just now beginning to understand some of the unintended consequences to negative interest rates. But in its simplest form, you know, you, the investor, have to essentially pay to keep your money in a savings account at a bank. Now, Europe and Japan, they've really done this in an attempt to spur more inflation, more economic growth and activity across their respective economies. But regarding its impact on the U.S. and the rest of the world, I think we've already begun to see an impact. You know, most were surprised earlier this year when our rates here in the U.S. went as low as they did. And some of that has switched back. And rates are and were historically low here in the U.S. But when you compare our rates to Europe and Japan, all of a sudden our rates look rather high on a relative basis. So it's just a reminder that it is a global market for bonds. It's going to be hard for our rates to get too far ahead of Europe and Japan and other major world economies with negative rates. Supply and demand dictates that buyers of bonds will simply buy the highest interest rate, which then puts upward pressure on those bond prices and downward pressure on those rates.
Well, I find it to be such an interesting anomaly. And tell me where an investor can come up with some enthusiasm to buy a yield that's less than zero, or at least at zero, and buy an instrument that bears no return at all. Who gets excited about that?
Sure. It's a good question. It's the next obvious question. Why would anyone voluntarily buy a bond that's going to cost you money as an investor? Or you know, why would you put money in a savings account that costs you money? And first off, most retail investors, just average investors, won't and are not making this choice. They're trying to avoid that, certainly. But there are also large pension, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, and the like that have to own a certain percentage of their portfolios in these domestic bonds. So they do have sort of a captive audience of investors that are in some ways forced into these instruments. Now, there are also different short-term trading strategies that allow for profit-making in these sorts of bond instruments. You know, in short, there are a number of reasons to transact in these instruments, and they don't involve a long-term investment strategy. But let's also remember negative interest rates cut both ways, and it really depends on whether you're a saver or a borrower. While you wouldn't want a savings account that costs you money, conversely, you'd love to be able to take loans out that pay you to take that risk. Just recently, for example, Denmark issued its first negative rate mortgage in August of this year. So you can buy a property and get paid to do so. The mechanics are not quite that simple, but that's the general idea.
Well, in such an unusual interest rate environment, has it affected, Ian, how, you know, you look at managing portfolios?
Well, to the extent negative rates have impacted our bond markets, you know, we're certainly conscious of that, but we're not making any meaningful changes to our investments. We have, though, discussed internally what we would do if negative rates made their way to the U.S., and oddly enough, I think our general consensus across our investment team would be to focus even more on stocks at that point because, you know, frankly, bonds and cash probably wouldn't make any sort of sense in that environment.
Tim, now, it seems that the market's been taking cues mainly from the tariffs and trade negotiations that still make it into the financial press as much as anything else. Why are the tariffs still front and center in investors' mind at this point?
Well, I think that's because on the margin, the tariffs are keeping our economy and China's economy and Europe's economy firing on just five or six cylinders. We're not getting that perfect storm of conditions that can lead to the optimum economic growth around the world. When these tariffs were first put into place, I think the estimates were that they would cost S&P 500 companies about 2 percentage points worth of earnings, maybe 3 percentage points, and that seems to be bearing out. It doesn't seem like a lot, but again, we're talking about on the margin. When you were only expecting in 2019 maybe 5% earnings growth, and you take 3% away from that and you're down to 2, that's now a big difference in how you should value companies. So that's what's really been shocking the market from time to time when we hear more trade news. And certainly what it's been doing is it's been keeping the value of the U.S. dollar elevated. I think since the trade talks and the tariffs went into place more than a year ago, the dollar's elevated about 7% against other currencies. That's undercut the sales and operating profits of a lot of multinational companies. It's disrupted supply chains and shipping. It's disrupted the flow of workers and visas. There's a lot of spin-off effects just from, you know, putting $100 billion worth of taxes on some goods. And it's causing some select industries and select companies really to be picked on, both by our government and by China, as they just try to, solve these issues and really want to bring capricious actions against a lot of, private companies that, and it's really impacting, their ability to sell into each other's countries right now.
Okay. So, guys, this year the market is up, close to 25%. I know that while it may surprise a lot of Wall Street, doesn't surprise you two guys, because I heard you both at the investment forum back in January predicting a market of, perhaps 15% or better. But by the way, you were wrong. It's, well over 20 and you only predicted 15. But how do you view this year's rally and any opportunity for this to continue?
Well, I think we started the year, as you said, thinking at least a 10% rally was going to be likely. And you got to go back to the fourth quarter of 2018 when we had a large correction, and we thought by the end of the year that the stocks were about 10% undervalued and it would take a 10 or 11% rally in stocks just to bring up the fair value, and we thought that was doable and that the market then would have to earn anything above 10%, through earnings growth. And I think that's really come to bear. We've got that 10% rally. It occurred in the first part of the year. We've been waiting for the earnings growth. Now, this has been the tricky part of the market in trying to evaluate, valuation versus market improvements, because earnings growth has been very sluggish the last couple of quarters, almost non-existent as we've been in kind of a profits recession. But you got to remember the stock market's always a leading indicator. Market is trying to forecast what's going to happen 6 to 9 months from now, and right now they're forecasting that some of these trade issues and the interest rate issues and the economic issues are going to be settled by then.
Okay. And Tim just mentioned, moderating earnings growth. When you look at the market and current valuations today, has it become a concern for you in the face of moderating earnings growth?
Well, just to step back and just cover the overall market for a moment. I mean, if we just pick on the S&P 500 as a proxy for that, we don't see the stock market as particularly cheap right now, but we also wouldn't characterize it as excessively valued. I mean, it's trading at roughly 20 times next year's earnings, but that's within a pretty reasonable range that we found ourselves over the last few years. In fact, the broader market's been trading in that range really since 2012, 2013. But, as with any market, there are pockets of the stock market that look expensive to us, and then there are other areas where it's much easier to find good values.
Okay. Tim, you look back over the last few years when there was a really good market year, and it tended to be dominated by just a handful of stocks pushing the indexes. The FANGs kind of was a popular term used. It still is. This rally that we've enjoyed this year, is it terribly isolated, or is it broad-based? Do you see it being more value-driven or more growth-driven?
I think there's two components to the rally this year. We were worried in the first half of the year that it was very top-heavy. We got great returns, and it was front-loaded by a lot of technology stocks. The S&P 500 was mostly led by 10 or 12 NASDAQ and FANG stocks. And that worried us because that's a common symptom when the market is fearing that the business cycle is occurring, and the market is reaching a cyclical peak. And when that occurs, there's always a movement of money into growth stocks. That is the last vestiges or pockets of growth that you can get in the market, and the market starts dumping the defensive stocks and anything that's not growing anymore. And suddenly we've gotten a surge in the second half of the year because we've got a decline in interest rates. We've got some relief on the trade front. And we've seen now a surge of defensive stocks. Now, here we are at the end of the year, and it's really, if you look at your portfolio, it's been the best of both worlds because the tech stocks gave great returns for the first 2.5 quarters of the year. The defensives have come to rally. And now you look at a portfolio and you see stocks like Google that's up almost 30% this year. Apple, which is having a fantastic year and up almost 70%, and Facebook up another 50%, I think. And then you balance it out with companies like AT&T, which is up almost 40% this year, and Medtronic and other healthcare stocks up 20 to 25%, and Bank America and other banks up 30%. So it's been a great year all the way around for value and growth, and you know, to our credit, we've loaded portfolios with both.
Ian, if you know, looking at the market today and you were putting cash in, would you be leaning more towards value, more towards growth, or would you be pretty even?
Well, we think it certainly makes sense for the vast majority of our clients to have a good mix of both growth and value sorts of companies. Trying to time, you know, which segment of the market is going to do well in the short term is, in our minds, just another form of market timing in general, but that's certainly something we're against. But as I mentioned earlier, there are pockets of over and undervaluation in any market. And today, given where interest rates are hovering and the performance of these areas over the last few years, there's probably a little bit more upside potential for the value segment of the market at this point. You know, just consider what's driven markets largely over the past few years. It's been growth, as Tim alluded to. And so there's almost always a reversion to the mean at some point. So, you know, when we look back 2 or 3 years from now, my guess would be that value probably outperforms growth modestly, but that's not a reason to just segment all your assets in the value space and ignore good quality growth companies.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I mentioned a moment ago the investment forum from last year. That's where we have an opportunity to forecast returns for the year. I'm going to jump ahead of the game. I'm not going to wait till January. I'm going to put you on the spot right now, Ian. This is the $100,000 question. Do you think this market is positioned for another strong year in 2020?
Well, first off, while Tim and I would love to take credit for being clairvoyant, West, our positive expectations for 2019 back in January were firmly rooted in the reality of what a bad fourth quarter the market experienced late last year, with the sell-off starting in October, a little bit of a relief rally in November, and then a big sell-off that we all remember in December of 2018. So our expectations for a good 2019 were really on the back of what was a pretty dismal end of the year in 2018. So just carrying that logic forward, we're now sitting here towards the end of 2019. We're up, you know, 20, 25%. We should, I think, have more modest expectations for 2020. I would say appreciation somewhere around 5% next year seems reasonable. That's assuming we're able to stave off recessionary concerns for another year. There's nothing particularly magical about that assumption. It just seems reasonable given the strong year we've had.
Okay. Now, we've just come through the reporting earnings season of the September quarter. Tim, what were the main takeaways that you're seeing from those earnings reports?
Well, I would say it's a continuation of the trend that I've seen for the last 3 or 4 quarters, that U.S. companies are still finding ways to hit all their goals and their targets, no matter what the headwinds are from the economies around the world. I've been very pleased to see that among the companies we're following, I think 70 to 75% of them beat their earnings estimates in this latest quarter. I think at least 50% of them beat on the revenue side. Now, granted, they had been reducing expectations and talking the market down in terms of their growth rates, but then they beat those reduced growth rates, and that's why we've seen a spark and a rally in these companies in the last several weeks. When I look at the companies in the aggregate, I'm noticing that revenues in general and operating profits are up about 3% year over year, and that's been holding for the last 3 quarters at around 3% per year, and that's a far cry from 2017 and 18 when companies were growing at 10%, but it's been holding. There was this worry that sales and operating profits were really going to deteriorate and possibly go negative this year. That hasn't happened, so that's been a buoy to the market. And if I had to look at some of the other takeaways, I've been noticing that the companies that are having the most sluggish time right now are the ones who are operating overseas. Domestic-based companies, those that are selling mostly into the North American, U.S., and Canadian markets are doing just fine. They haven't slowed down one bit in the aggregate. Tech, of course, is still growing. Companies are still rich in cash flow and buying back stock to help boost their per-share earnings. And, of course, we've had some companies that have been aided by mergers and been allowed to use merger accounting and restructuring charges to make their returns even better.
So in looking across kind of the breadth of the earnings reports, are there unique or are there, you know, kind of grouped reasons for high points in companies doing well, grouped reasons for low points where companies, you know, maybe have underreported? Which industries, you know, are kind of faring the best and worst as you're looking to?
Well, I always like to look at sales and operating profits first. If a company's growing its sales, there's a lot of natural positive things that happen to the share price. When companies are stagnating and shrinking, managements have to resort to a lot of unnatural things to keep propping up their share price. So I'm looking for companies that are still growing 10 years into an economic cycle, and we've got plenty of those, everything from companies like Disney that, you know, its revenues, I think, grew more than 30% in the last quarter. Microsoft's had 14 or 15% earnings or sales growth in this last quarter. Facebook, of course, was near 30% on the growth side. Brookfield Asset Management, a company we've added to portfolios a couple years ago, was growing at 20%. You can go right down the list. A number of companies are still showing revenues and operating profit growth well in excess of GDP, and those are the companies we've been relying on quite a bit, you know, to get good returns for clients. On the other side of the coin, there are a few industries that are stagnating, no doubt about it. The oil, energy, and gas industry has been struggling for a couple years now. Multinational manufacturers have seen a profit and sales recession, railroads I mentioned, a few industrials, and even companies like Home Depot, which had been one of our favorites since about 2010. We're noticing it's starting to slow down a little bit, and it had to rely this morning on a lot of share buybacks really to prop up earnings and you know, boost positive returns.
Ian, we're going to just kind of step back a little bit. We've received some questions to kind of look at the asset allocation theme and back to asset class selection between stocks, bonds, cash, and such. Folks want to know whether, you know, when you see, you know, meaningful movements in valuation, you know, across a portfolio in the equity or the fixed income classes, does that create a reason to make adjustments, you know, on a more tactical basis? Do you tend to look at what's going on in the markets and then readjust asset allocation scenarios based on what's going on?
That's a good question. I think most people would assume the answer is yes, we do adjust. But, you know, really what drives our long-term asset allocation plans for our clients are those conversations we've had with our clients periodically where we discuss their goals. We figure out what it is they're really trying to achieve with their portfolios. And that really sets the parameters for asset allocation. Now, within, you know, if we decide on, let's, by way of example, an 80-20 mix between stocks and bonds, you know, it's up to the portfolio manager to kind of pick and choose what sorts of stocks you want to own, what areas of the bond market make sense. But broad-based asset allocation decisions, frankly, in our mind, should not change just based on, you know, what's worked over the last 6 to 12 months.
When you look at the rally that we've been enjoying in the stock market, what asset classes look appealing to you today?
Well, just on a pure standalone basis, and we're going to sound like a broken record here because we've been saying this for years, but stocks are certainly a better value than bonds today, and that's just reflective of how low bond yields are. But that statement also doesn't really account for risk or volatility within a portfolio. So it again comes back to an individual discussion with our clients and making sure we're kind of taking their temperature appropriately in terms of the amount and the level of risk they're willing to be exposed to. So, you know, if risk were not a consideration, I think most people would be inclined to just stick with a full stock market portfolio. But obviously there are other things that make that discussion a little bit more complicated.
Staying on that theme, I mean, yields on bonds this year have, you know, they've been low, they've gone lower, they've actually moved up a little bit over times, and there's been a, you know, a moment or two where you begin to think, is this the economy stabilizing? Is this an opportunity to be more opportunistic and start adding into fixed income portfolios? What makes you think, or when would you be eager to start jumping in and adding more bonds?
Yeah, I think, again, it comes back to what is the individual portfolio or client relationship looking for? Certainly, if there is a desire to reduce risk in a portfolio, this seems like as good a time as any to think about maybe reducing stock exposure modestly, putting some more cash and bonds into a portfolio. Again, that's only for clients where it makes sense to reduce risk, where a client's living off of their portfolio in a meaningful way. I don't want to give the impression that you shouldn't have 100% in stocks, because it really does tie back to your individual circumstances. But just given the rally we've had in the past just few weeks in yields, I mean, you know, the 10-year Treasury is now yielding, I think, 1.8, 1.9. A few weeks ago, it was yielding 1.5. So, you know, I'd much rather buy into a 1.9% yield than a 1.5% yield. So fixed income has become slightly more attractive just in the past few weeks. And then when you couple that with the stock markets just moving further ahead, you know, I think it's probably not – you could find worse times to kind of reconsider risk levels in your portfolio.
I'm going to stick with you, Ian, just one more on this. Do you think we will see any more rate increases or decreases from the Fed in the near future?
Well, certainly no rate increases anytime soon. The futures market, it's really the best barometer for what market participants believe the Fed will do in the coming months. And the futures market is telling us today that they do not expect the Fed to increase rates really at any point in 2020. And actually, as you move out towards September or October of next year, it's actually more likely the Fed may lower rates at this point and not raise them. And that's just, again, that's the conventional wisdom of the market informing that opinion.
Tim, do you have anything to add on your assessment for the U.S. economy? You know, are we growing enough to keep values of businesses growing?
Oh, I think so. The U.S. economy is still on track to grow maybe 1.5% to 2.5% in 2020. And if we get some resolution to the trade talks, maybe you can up that to 2% to 2.5% for next year. You throw inflation on top of that, I think that gives the ability for companies in the United States to grow their sales at about 4% or you know, annually. That's enough to increase business values. The economy's underpinning right now is still very strong, even though we're at a more reduced 1.5% to 2.5% growth rate. Unemployment, rate is at a 50-year low. The employment trends are very strong. Household spending is very strong. Household debt levels are low and manageable. And then there are no classic signs that we're peaking, you know, with our economy. There's no excess capacity in any key industry right now. Bank lending is still very secure and safe, and loan losses at banks is very, you know, cyclically low right now to indicate that banks are not going to be in any trouble anytime soon and would start contracting credit. Those are all positive signs that can tell me that our economy is still on decent enough footing to, you know, allow businesses to keep growing next year.
Okay. Now, this has been a great conversation so far, and I don't want to change that, but I'm going to change the topic a little bit. I want to ask you now about the election cycle coming up. You know, it doesn't seem to be impacting the market much now, but some of the candidates' proposals have large impact potential on the economy, taxes, government spending. How are you handicapping the election, and what are your thoughts on some of the campaign proposals you're hearing?
I think you got to wear two hats when you're trying to answer a question like this. It's just an individual, when I'm at home watching the debates on television and thinking about the proposals, I have to think about the impacts on my own household, as millions of others are going to be doing. When I'm at work and I sit at my desk, I have to think about how this is going to impact companies and their profits, and I have to think about the impacts on clients and, you know, whether or not some of these proposals are actually painting a target on some clients' backs, in which case we have to think about reversing some strategies in the next couple of years. A lot of that's just conjecture at this point. We're so early in the economic and political cycle that I think it's just kind of a deadly game to try to assume that what's being proposed on television right now is going to play out after November of next year. Having said that, there's a few things that, you know, we'd have to look out for that could impact valuations of and the stock market. One would be the corporate tax rate. If the tax bill of 2017 gets rescinded, corporate tax rate will jump back up to 35%. That has a huge impact negatively on corporate valuations and on stock prices, just in the same way that the decline in tax rates to 21% pushed up the prices of the average stock of 20-25%. If we saw the estate tax exemptions rescinded back to 2017 levels, that's going to put a lot of our clients back into the realm of facing estate taxes. So we've got other discussions that will have to occur. So we're going to be looking at things like that, but it's still a little early in our belief that we're going to start handicapping and trying to predict a winner or loser right now.
Is there anything investors should take from the impeachment hearings?
At this point, if you look at the way the market is reacting to the impeachment hearings, it is a non-event. And I say that because the market will take all the proceedings seriously, no doubt about that. But in the end, it looks like it's going to be such a partisan divide in the decision-making that the House will probably vote to impeach and the Senate will vote to acquit, and then we'll move on and we'll have an election. We'll let the American voters decide who they want in office, you know, after 2019, after 2020. So the market has not picked up on the impeachment and is really taking it seriously at this point.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you both, guys. I love the conversation we've had today. All of us at the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company and its divisions, the Naples Trust Company and the Tampa Bay Trust Company, thank you for joining us on today's call. If you'd like to keep this conversation going, our portfolio managers are happy to visit with you at your convenience. I hope you have a great evening. Thank you so much. Happy Thanksgiving.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.